From the Sky News Centre at 6, Rio Ferdinand has replaced John Terry as England captain. The Chelsea defender has been stripped of the armband following allegations about his private life. David Davies, the former executive director of the Football Association, knows how much the role meant to him.
He would have dreamt of leading England to World Cup success, of following Bobby Moore in South Africa this coming summer.
Terry says he'll continue to give everything for his country, and the woman at the centre of allegations about Terry's private life says she won't be talking publicly. In other news, a wealthy Gloucestershire landowner has been found guilty of murdering his wife, who disappeared 2 years ago. Kate Pratt went missing the day after she demanded an £800,000 divorce settlement from her estranged husband, Adrian. Outside Bristol Crown Court, Kate's brother, Richard Wakefield, says the family is relieved at the guilty verdict.
This will go some way towards allowing us to move forward. We would, however, appeal to Adrian to tell us what happened to Kate and where she is, because we would like to lay her to rest and say our goodbyes.
Three Labour MPs and a Tory peer have been charged over their expense claims. Elliot Morley, David Chater and Jim Devine, along with Lord Hanningfield, all insist they're innocent of false accounting charges. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has welcomed the agreement reached between Northern Ireland's political parties after 2 weeks of talks. The deal means policing and justice powers will be devolved from April the 12th. A record number of us were officially made bankrupt last year. More than 35,000 people were declared insolvent in England and Wales in the last quarter of 2009, up almost a quarter. The London market suffered a second day of heavy losses because of concerns about growing debts in Europe. The FTSE 100 share index recovered to some ground to close down 78 points at 50.60. And a Hollywood film company is forcing a firm in Northampton to change its name. MGM says 007 Refrigeration is infringing its copyright on the James Bond franchise. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Had a funny turn. Perhaps your speech was slurred or you couldn't pick up your cup of tea. You may well have had a mini stroke, also called a TIA. Mini strokes are an early warning sign. Spotting the signs of a mini stroke early and getting treatment can significantly reduce the risk of a full-blown stroke. Like a stroke, a mini stroke happens when the flow of blood to the brain is blocked by a small clot. But unlike a full stroke, with a mini stroke you'll often feel much better within a few hours. Don't ignore them. If you think you may have had a mini stroke in the past, talk to your GP. Strokes happen to people we care about. Act fast. Brought to you by NHS Bristol.
Oh, it's so bright here. You put off the petals. Miles, you go as the crow flies, but for airport delays, you're dizzy with jet lag. But I am here by your side, shock to the heart. And who understand the finer point, shock to the heart. Who wouldn't understand? Pulled apart. Oh, pulled apart. Yeah, shock to the heart.
Pulled apart, yeah, shocked to Very, very relaxing stuff there. Q Fanfare with the sound of Shock to the Heart. If you like that and would like to see more of it, then get yourselves down to the Louisiana at 8 p.m. on Thursday the 11th of February, where you can also witness Pete Stillwell and the wonderful musings of Darker Dogs. I'm Billy Quain. I'm here with What's On To Do for Not Very Much Money in the city of Bristol for the week ahead. Tony and the team have stepped out of the studio for a moment to grab their breath, and I'm here to launch into What's On. My God, there's a lot of it. I'm giving you good advance warning. The Love Food Festival is on St. Valentine's Day, Sunday the 14th of February at Paintworks Bristol. It starts at 10:30 a.m. and runs till 4 p.m. in the afternoon. It's free entry. Celebrate Valentine's Day in style with your loved ones. Beautiful food, gifts and art, children's activities, music, bar and much, much more. If you would like more info on that, go to lovefoodfestival.com. Lunchtime concert season is back at the Victoria Rooms on this tomorrow evening. You can go and see the Bristol University Chamber Orchestra they're doing Wagner's Siegfried Idyll. The Bristol University Symphony Orchestra, which means the brass is coming in for the second half, are doing Brahms Symphony No. 4 and Bernard Rand Ceremony No. 3. That will cost you £10, I'm afraid. However, on Wednesday, you can go along and hear the Wells Cathedral School String Ensemble, conducted by Catherine Lord, doing a free concert at 1:15 p.m. It's a varied program of music for a string orchestra and various ensembles from within the group. That is free. Also free, get yourselves along on Wednesday evening to the City of Bristol Museum. Up at the top of Park Street, it's the Powell Lecture Theatre up there. Ronald Hutton examines the remains of ancient religions found in Britain, Ireland and their offshore islands. He will explore the evidence of pre-Christian ritual and the belief that belief from the Old Stone Age to the conversion of Christianity. That is at 7:30 p.m. You do need to get tickets for that. If you would like more information, log on to the website bristol.gov.uk/museums. Also free this week, Thursday the 11th of February from 10:30 a.m. till 12:30 p.m. at Westbury Library, Sheila Hannan of Shaw Strength Theatre Company is hosting a free writing workshop. No booking is necessary for the Westbury on Trim Trading Local. If music at lunchtime is more your bag, then get yourselves along to Christ Church on Broad Street in Bristol. It's the Church of the Quarterjacks. And on the 10th, Colin Scobie on the violin and Simon Hogan on the piano, who are both teachers from the Royal College of Music. They're playing Dvorak Four Romantic Pieces and the Elgar Sonata. This Saturday, on the 6th of February, there is a making and doing seminar down at the Arnold Feeney. This seminar will reflect on the contemporary interest in art in... I'm going to read this to you carefully. This seminar will reflect on the contemporary interest in the craft and wider creative strategies that correspond to the conditions of post-industrial labour and artisanship. The event asks, what drives this resurgent interest in craft processes and customization? How oppositional are craftists' tactics? How much are they simply recuperated as free labour and innovation? There are presentations by Glenn Adamson, the head of graduate studies at the V&A, and Catherine Hemmerlich, the co-curator of Extreme Crafts. And there you go. That's on at what time? 2 p.m. and it runs till 5. It will cost you £3. Then on Friday, there's a Labour Behind the Label workshop. At 1 p.m. next Friday the 12th, and that's free. An interactive workshop on living wages for garment factory workers in conjunction with Stephen Sucho's Anti-Factory Bristol project. That is all down at the Arnold Feeney. If you would like to go and see some drama, actually, no, I've got one last free thing that I want to mention to you, because it's happening here tomorrow. It's Gardening for Wildlife workshop, Saturday, 6th of February, Russelltown Avenue, Allotments. So they're behind the City Academy, which is where our studios are based. It starts at 1 p.m. and it runs till 4 p.m. and it's free. Here's how it goes. Find out how to create spaces in your garden or allotment to support natural wildlife and help create a pond that will foster frogs at Russelltown Avenue. Bring a large plastic pot to this workshop led by the fantastic Mr. Foster, and you'll have a chance to take away a young native tree. So that's quite good fun. 1 o'clock tomorrow, bring a plastic box thing. Right, if you like going to see plays, then get yourselves along to the Somerset Hall in Portishead at 7:30 for the next, starts on Thursday, runs till Saturday next week. They're doing Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, and they are the Portishead Players. If you would like further information on that, it's 01275 843 169. On Saturday night this week, you can go and see Phil Beer at Fiddler's. That's in associate, brought to you with Midnight Mango Productions and Jelly Records. So that's good fun there. That will cost you money, I'm afraid. Now, important stuff going on at the Colston Hall in the next week or so. Tuesday, in fact. I've lost my page. I'll come back to it. The 22nd, you have got Oamu Sangare, the Orchestra Polyrhythmo, and the Kalahari Surfers. This is a major UK tour, and it's the first time that the Orchestra Polyrhythmo have been seen in the UK. It's going to cost you quite a lot of money, but it's on the 22nd. There we go. Winter Song is still running at the Bristol Old Vic this week. If you're getting out of the house this weekend, go and see June Tabor or Saladay, 7:30 p.m. tonight and midday tomorrow. June Tabor is at 7:30 p.m. tomorrow evening. That's prior to the Winter Song Festival. We have still got A Warning to the Curious, Nunky Theatre Company's The M.R. James Trilogy. And that is running, it's performed by Robert Lloyd Parry at the Brewery Theatre on North Street in Bedminster. I can recommend it strongly. Tomorrow evening, I had a word with Robert Lloyd Parry. It starts at 5:30 because he's doing all six stories as part of the trilogy. So, It runs from 5:30 and then there's a little break and then the next two stories are on at 7:30 and there's a little break and the next two stories are on at 9:30. And I think there are concessionary rates available for that. However, don't quote me on it because I may be wrong. On Thursday, the 11th of February, Mushy's Bagel are coming back to St. George's. They do Balkan klezmer dance music. They're great stuff indeed. And then tomorrow night, the Brendan Hill Chamber Orchestra. Tonight, however, there are still some tickets, limited tickets available to go and see Natalie Klein playing her cello and Zhengqing Fui, who is a guitarist, a Chinese guitarist, and they're doing a very exciting programme. I will play you a little bit of Bach to bring the guys back into the studio, which is almost now. There we are. I found my place at the Colston Hall. There is a lot of very, very good stuff coming through. The Czech National Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Libo Pešek are coming through on Tuesday evening at 7:30 p.m. to play Schubert's Unfinished Symphony No. 8, the Dvorak Violin Concerto played by Charlie Seam, and Dvorak Symphony No. 8. That's on Tuesday. And then on Thursday, you've got the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra under Carol Karabetis baton, and Peter Jablonski is coming to play the Scarabin Piano Concerto, Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5, which is a real favourite of mine, and Berlioz, the Overture to Beatrice and Benedict. And then next Friday, the 12th of, that's in March actually, I've confused myself, there is something on there next Friday as well. Up at the RWA, I would urge you to go and see the new, the two new exhibitions which have opened up there, Urban Evolution and Celebrating Paper. Kelvin Players are opening Neil Butte's The Shape of Things on the 16th of February and is running till the 20th. If you would like to tune into my show, the Bristol Arts Show with me, Billy Quain, tomorrow between 10 a.m. and midday, I have got two members of the Kelvin Players coming in to see me. Important next Thursday, the Shakespeare at the Tobacco Factory spring season opens with Midsummer Night's Dream, and that opens on the 30 on next Thursday evening. And there is a special this is one for the diary. Saturday, 13th of March, from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m., the director of Shakespeare at the Tobacco Factory, Andrew Hilton, and members of the cast are joining in a public art talk, and this is, you have to book tickets for that actually, and it's basically a lecture with Andrew Hilton and the cast, and you can talk about all sorts of stuff that goes on. You do have to pay for that, however. Full details on the Tobacco Factory website. Now, this weekend, not this weekend, in fact, it's Thursday the 11th at 7 p.m. Get yourselves down to the Apple Art Show, which is in the Apple Cider Bar in Welsh Bank. Bristol Cider Boat, the Apple, is lucky enough to have four great young artists amongst its staff. This February, Cassie Jo Sims, Sophia Juris, Samantha Mabley and Benny Casey will be staging a month-long nautical-themed exhibition on the boat, sponsored by everyone's favourite nautical-themed drink, Jolly Sailor. That's free. Sprockets and Dust, if you want to dust off your bicycle, then get yourselves down to the Cube Cinema at 8 p.m. on Saturday. For some reason, I have no idea. Then there's the Eastern Pancake Race, which is on Tuesday the 16th of February to celebrate that. That's all I've got time for. This is Bach, played by Mischa Majski, not by the other woman who's playing it at St. George's this evening, Natalie Klein. There we go. I've got it right this time. Listen carefully. If you would like to hear this in its entirety, you have about 1 hour and 15 minutes to get to St. George's to get yourself a ticket where you can hear it in its entirety. Thank you very much. I've been Billy Quain. Please tune in to the Bristol Arts Show from 10 a.m. till midday tomorrow, and we will have great fun again. That is the sound of Bach's cello suite number 1 in G. That is the prelude, as played for us by Mischa Majski. Now, Tony and Martin have just reminded me that we played that last week as well, for which I apologise. I didn't remember, but it's worth hearing twice. And Natalie Klein is playing the whole of suite number 1 in G at St. George's this evening from 7 p.m. onwards. 7:30 p.m, I beg your pardon.
Okay, how much are the tickets, Billy, do you know?
Well, I got a discount on mine because I carry a card in my pocket. I think I paid £9, but they do go up as far as 21 for the very, very expensive seats.
Now, we've kept you on this week for a few minutes just to discuss something that's in the Bristol Evening Post earlier this week in the ever fun letters page from Tuesday, February the 2nd. This is the second time in a couple of weeks there's been almost an entire page devoted to comments about Radio Bristol. And this time it's, here's what we think, Radio Bristol. City's broadcaster is no longer for our people, which is the lead letter was the lead letter on Tuesday. I would like to say how much I agree with recent letters regarding Radio Bristol. I'd like to nominate the radio station as the most irritating. Jingles for past programmes, jingles for future. How many times does Graham Torrington have to tell us who we are listening to, the phone number, email, etc.? It sounds to me like there's not too many jingles on there. And that's from Jill Stafford, Whitehall Road in Bristol. And in fact, there's a whole load of letters. And also, I hear you've had a little disappointment to do with Radio Bristol as well, Billy.
Well, I applied for a part-time, you know, fader monkey job up there, and they gave me a very polite PFO. And I used the acronym because I was a little upset about it. I feel I've served my time. I'm pretty well educated. I do voluntary work down here, and I know how the studio works and what broadcasters are supposed to do, what listeners like to listen to. Although I'm not sure how many listeners I have. I know that you have an awful lot of listeners, but the Bristol Arts Show with me, Billy Quain, on Saturday mornings between 10 a.m. and midday may not have quite so many. I do, however, know a little bit of the politic of what goes on inside the walls of White Ladies Road. It's not fair of any of us, really, and I think a lot of the contributors to the Evening Post would agree with me on this. it's not fair to tar all of the presenters with the same brush. I think Ben Prater, who does the Drive Time show, he's your direct opposition. He does a very good job, and he's been there sort of man and boy. He's been there for at least 10 years and cut his teeth with the station. Keith Warmington is a legend, and let's be honest, Trevor Fry does put the West Country to sleep every night. But there is a lot, there is a wealth of new, I suppose you could argue it's talent, but it's not. I think Tim Pemberton's recruitment policy seems to go for, certainly in terms of presenters, looking for experience as opposed to trying to develop a lot of the talent that is extant in their newsroom and within other broadcast outlets around the city.
Well, my impression is that there seems to be a sort of a attempt to have a very safe kind of sound where nobody's going to be controversial. Well, as far as I'm concerned, controversial radio is what people want to listen to.
Well, controversial or just diverting radio. I think that's the mainstay of a lot of these letters, is that Radio Bristol is just so banal and so ordinary and could be for any city were it not for the traffic reports. You know, it could be radio anywhere, is one of the letters from a fortnight ago. And I kind of agree with it. And it's not puerile, it's just uninteresting. And it really is becoming very much the aha, Alan Partridge sort of broadcasting out of Radio Norwich.
Now, last time we were discussing this, Martin made the point that why is our programme not being slagged off in the Evening Post like Radio Bristol is, and he was complaining. But as you can see from this page from the Bristol Evening Post from Tuesday, now BCFM does actually get a mention here.
Oh, do we?
Do we get slagged?
Are we getting slagged?
Unfortunately,
off as well?
Not.
So it's a positive letter.
Unfortunately, it's quite positive.
Yes, I just take this opportunity to urge all of your listeners to write to the Evening Post to complain about the shoddy service that BCFM is providing absolutely for free from a team of volunteers. And maybe if we can get, I guess we probably need about 8 letters to fill up a whole letters page. So maybe we should start a little campaign to venture spleens about...
There's no such thing as bad publicity, is there?
Right. Do you know what? It would be nice just to know what the public thinks of what we're doing.
It's also always, for me, whenever I see this kind of thing, and particularly listening to some of the programmes on Radio Bristol, it's become a kind of parody of the old Radio West from the Shoestring days.
Absolutely.
We talked about this last time, but that was actually a fantastic series, which I don't think is available on DVD for some reason.
They are showing it on one of the satellite stations. It's, you know, because they go back through the back catalogue, and they are doing reruns.
A classic bit of drama made in the city, and what's happened is Radio Bristol seems to have slipped effortlessly into the role of Radio West, which was this sort of stale old presenters, stale old programmes that was portrayed by the BBC drama people back in the 80s.
Yes, but you know, I mean, it's a shame because Bristol deserves better than what it's been given. My grievance at the moment with them is they have a sports department of 6 individuals, and Jeff Twentyman, former Bristol Rovers captain, I think, is head of that department. They do quite a good job. There's 25 hours dedicated output every week to sport. There isn't one single individual up there who's responsible for arts and culture across the city, and there are more people go and see a gig or a theatre event or go and see a show across the city every week than there are go and see Bristol City, Bristol Rovers, the Bristol Rugby and Gloucester Cricket Club.
Anyway, I left a message with the BBC today and with Tim Pemberton, inviting him on this programme to discuss the week's news and also to maybe to explain some of his policies, particularly to do with getting rid of some of the most popular programmes at the weekend, the David Lowe programme particularly, which is a fantastic show. I do hope that's not going to go, and so maybe we'll have a bit of an explanation from him. I don't know if we're going to be hearing it on Radio Bristol. Maybe we'll hear it here on BCFM in the next few weeks.
The thing is, Tony, you have invited him to your show. I think it would be impolite, to say the least, for him to make his response on his own station. You know, you've extended the cordial invitation for him to come down.
We could have a war of the airwaves. Come on.
Oh, it doesn't have to be a war. Let's just have a discussion and find out where he's coming from.
Or
anyway,
where he wants it to go. That's the other thing. I mean, it seems to be a bit of a rudderless ship at the moment.
Okay.
We leave there.
Let's leave it at that for the time being. And no doubt we'll come back, as we said last time, to discuss this in future weeks. Yes,
thank you very much. Yes,
Billy.
Natalie Klein at St. George's. Don't miss it.
Okay. Now we're just welcoming Jerry Coulter back. And Jerry was our guest in the first half of the programme to discuss the week's news. Is a karate judge and an expert, a karate expert, as well as an engineer, and was a victim of the Freemasons. We discussed briefly at the the beginning of the first hour of the programme, what led Jerry to his first clash with the Freemasons. And as you explained, Jerry, then, it all began with the theft of your car. Can you just explain how that developed further into, you know, you getting to know who the local Freemasons were, who were actually, as you believed anyway, responsible for your car theft?
Yeah, I mean, well, basically, I was getting a lot of councillors that I was lobbying on the police authority and the local council in Bournemouth and in other parts of Dorset, saying to me, look, you know, you want to be a bit careful. This is all to do with Freemasonry. You know, they're in the police force, they're in the council, they're everywhere down here. It's crawling with them. Well, when you come out of an area of West London like I do and then move to a rural area like Hertfordshire and things like that, you know, a lot of your old ways sort of go with you. And coming out of an engineering background, I'm dealing with logisticians and things, and so we look at theories and we analyse things, you know, and which is what we do in engineering. We find out why systems break down. And we have QA systems and ISO 9000 and audit and everything else. And one of the things that I do to do with quality control is when a system breaks down, it may not be necessary. I mean, obviously, I look at mechanical devices, a mechanical infrastructure. But when you're talking about other mechanisms, there are procedural mechanisms. For example, the judicial system is a procedural mechanism. The local authority is a procedural mechanism. They have their meetings, they have their members. These people are supposed to be the checks and balances in society. And I was in a rather expensive area of Hertfordshire. At that time, I was living in Kings Langley in Hertfordshire. And bearing in mind, I was married into an old Japanese samurai family. You know, I am an engineer. I've got a classic car collection and everything else. I'm hardly what you'd call left-wing. But I was the left-wing opposition in my area. I mean, the Labour didn't even field a candidate in North Ward, Kings Langley. Somebody had to oppose the Tories, and so it was me. And I opposed them on behalf of the Liberal Democrats for 19 years. Every time there was a local election, without opposition, you haven't got democracy. And, of course, I was the left-wing opposition. I was living in a house in an acre of its own ground with an indoor swimming pool, and I was the left-wing opposition. So it tells you what the others were like. A couple of goose steps to the right of Margaret Thatcher.
Okay. Now, down in when you were down in Dorset, one of the key things that helped you locate the fact that it was actually a Masonic plot behind the theft of your car was the getting hold of the list of the Dorset Freemasons. Can you explain to me what a revelation that was and how you got hold of it?
Well,
because these lists are guarded very, very closely by the Masonic societies, aren't they?
They are. They're very, very deeply guarded. But I put it this way, I was able to get hold of the Dorset yearbook. I've also got the Hertfordshire yearbook because I happen to live in that area. I've also got, within the group of people that I am campaigning with, we have these books. We've produce photocopies of them so that if anything ever happened to an original, we've always got copies, and we've got these things archived, and they're dispersed within the people that I'm working with. As I say, as a logistician, when people said to me this is all to do with Freemasonry, and when I was lobbying certain councillors, I was getting short shift, if not I was, you know, getting like veiled threats put against me and things like that. I thought, well, I'll just find out if it's so, and I made a point of getting hold of their yearbook. I don't know if I should really say how I got hold of it, but I didn't get hold of it illegally. I had it given to me, the same as I've had a lot of the others given to me. But the fact is, I managed to get hold of it, and I managed to go through it, and I found that my car had been passed or sold by the thief who was convicted of the theft. She it was a woman, actually, who had my car. My brother-in-law lent my car to his girlfriend, who then took my car and sold it to a Bournemouth car dealer, whose brother was a serving police sergeant and a member of Branksome Lodge, who thought he could walk on water, basically. And the head at that time of the County Council Legal Department was also in the same lodge as the police officer who was the brother of the car dealer that had my car illegally. He's bought it without logbooks or anything else. You know, he has no legal title to my car. And he'd done at civil law, which I finally got a judgment against him for, which was never enforced.
So are you saying that rather than being prosecuted for the car theft, you had to go through and take a private prosecution?
Not only for the car theft, but also my complaints. Dorset haven't had a policy to push all complaints into civil litigation. So, in other words, they just ignored criminal law. And the moment the thief pleaded guilty to the theft of my car was a stolen vehicle. That car should have been impounded by the police. And it should have been kept either for a magistrate to issue a warrant for the return of the vehicle, or, as they've tried to argue, there was some controversy as to the ownership of the vehicle, because the car was lent to my brother-in-law, Japanese brother-in-law, who happened to be in Bournemouth at the time, and he'd lent it to a girl who then decided to sell it, and she then had pleaded guilty to the theft of that car. But the actual point of the theft was the car dealer that bought the car from her, knowing that it was stolen. And then tried to hide the car and everything. And every time I tried to find out from the police are saying to me, this is a civil matter. And when I said, well, all right, tell me who's got my car and I'll put it in the hands of lawyers and I'll get a civil recovery. So they're telling me I've got to fight a civil suit, but not telling me who I've got to fight a civil suit against, despite the fact that they know from the interview tapes with the girl that stole my car who's got it. Eventually, he tried to do a complete conversion. A conversion is the civil equivalent of theft, which is he tried to get logbooks from our vehicle, from DVLA, which I'd blocked. And I had to do all this through lawyers. And once he did that, we knew exactly who had the car. Then I opened up a negotiation with him, or tried to. I tried to offer him £1,000 for my own car back, which I thought was reasonable, because it was going to cost me a lot of money to go through the civil courts to get an Order 14 for... which an Order 14 basically means he's got an undefendable position that for delivery of my car, because he could not get legal title to it, right? And I started that process with lawyers. And so I thought, well, I'll give you £1,000 for my car back. I'll, you know, save me the money with the legal fees, save me all the aggravation. And I was told, quote, you'll never get your car back. You serve any writs on me and I'll chop it up. It's worth more than £1,000 in pieces. I mean, bearing in mind, I had four Goodrich wheels on it, 15-inch wide American Goodrich wheels and everything. I mean, the wheels alone were worth more than the money I was offering him. And so I reported all this to Dorset Police. And basically, they were unforthcoming. As I say, there's lots of hanky-panky that I won't go into as to protecting this bloke. And they said, well, we've had an opinion from our legal advisor. Well, everything in Dorset is incestuous. It's either Freemasonry incestuous or it's incestuous with multiple hats and conflict of interest, people having more than one job.
But you're not telling me that some of the officials in Dorset, or all of the officials in Dorset, are in some way involved in Freemasonry, because there's plenty of women who apparently aren't allowed to be Freemasons.
Well, most of their wives are involved in official capacities. I'll come on to that later, what I found. But... I'll cut the long story short with the car. With the car, basically, what happened was I'm trying to lobby these councillors, and when I finally got hold of the Masonic book, all the ones that are giving me short shift and all the ones that are giving me, where to go sort of answers, are the common denominator is they all orbit two lodges, 3366, which is Dorset Master Masons Lodge, and 137 Amity Pool. The county council legal advisor that was advising the police not to impound my car, he was also in the same lodge as the police sergeant who was the brother of the car dealer that had my car. And he was also, this is where I'm talking about the incestuous bit, the reason the county council legal department provided legal services for the police, because he was married to Sue Davis, who was the deputy chief constable of Dorset Police at that time. So that in itself was incestuous. Okay, take the Freemasonry bit away from the equation. It's not healthy having the husband of the deputy chief constable defending the police in civil actions. And anyway, this is much larger than what I actually found out when I did the research in Dorset. As an outsider looking in, and as a logistician, it was easy for me to piece it all together. And being a political activist, a Liberal Democrat, I was lobbying Liberal councillors down there, and they put me onto the Freemasonry bit. And anyway, after that, because I was getting such a hostile reaction from various councillors down there, I thought, well, people that live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. I thought, if you're going to treat me like a criminal, a man with no criminal record, a man that's a victim of a car theft, and you're going to speak to me in that way, I'll see what you're doing. So I searched the planning record, and I then found that most of the brethren had been voting through planning applications for various property developers that were in their own lodges and not declaring an interest and standing down.
Well, isn't that actually officially a criminal offence?
That is a criminal offence.
To be voting, you know, in fact, even as a board of directors, never mind a council planning committee, that you have to step out of the meeting if you have any interest in the outcome of that particular, you know, any personal interest in the outcome of that particular decision.
One particular councillor, we found that he'd voted through 13 planning applications for a developer in his own lodge. I only honed in on the councillors who's been voting through applications for people in their own lodge, not some other lodge. So they can't say they didn't know them through Freemasonry. And you're quite right. They know they should have stood down. They know they shouldn't have had anything to do with it. And by doing that, they committed a prima facie criminal offence called misfeasance, misconduct in public office. It's a common law criminal offence. All of this was reported to Dorset Police, and of course, they did nothing about it. Chief Constable Jane Stitchbury covered it all up. I gave her documented evidence. I even got a BBC programme put together, which was never broadcast, only in the Dorset area.
Oh, that's right. This was a regional programme, wasn't it? Which is just a half an hour programme, which looked at some of the these allegations about planning applications and planning committees. And I was quite amazed because I saw that programme on the internet. And at one point, the BBC reporter is interviewing a councillor who he knows has connections through the Freemasons to people that he's given planning permission to. And then that is actually sprung on him. And he just completely doesn't know what to say because he's denying it. He said, well, yes, but you're in the same lodge as these people.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you saw, I mean, that particular councillor was Les Ames. I mean, all of this has been going on for quite a long time. The other problem with all of this, of course, is the reason the programme never went out is because
it didn't go out nationally. It went out on the regional opt-out, didn't it?
It should have gone nationally. It was scheduled to go nationally, and I should have got it because it was part of Southern Eye, and Southern Eye should have been broadcast on that day in Hertfordshire, and it wasn't. They pulled the plug on it. It only literally went out around the Southampton and Bournemouth area.
So what's the film called, if people want to have a look at it on the internet?
It's called Anything to Declare, because they didn't declare an interest. At the time, there was a local code of government conduct in force that all councillors had to abide by, and it was an SI, it was a statutory instrument, it was the same as a statute law, and it actually had worded in there that they must declare interests of trade union membership and Freemasonry. Now that's been done away with. Everything to do with curtailing Freemasonry by the government has been gradually eroded.
Well, I believe that all MPs and councillors have to fill in a form now declaring whether they're a member of a secret society. At least certainly 2 years ago they did, because I've seen those forms in Bristol City Council offices that new councillors have filmed in. Anyway, Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week, and her Vox Pop is all about Freemasonry. So let's have a look and see how people of Bristol, what they have to say about Freemasons
during the Falklands.
Sorry, that's the wrong one. Jerry, if you could just explain very, very briefly here, whether it's you think that what's been going on in Dorset, as you've proven, is maybe similar in other parts of the country.
Well, it is similar. I mean, you can extrapolate it into any other area. If you've got an improportionate amount of magistrates who are Freemasons, if you've got an improportionate amount of councillors that are Freemasons, and they're on the planning committee where people are objecting to contentious planning applications or any other application that might affect them, and their brethren from their own lodge is an applicant, they should be standing down, and if they don't stand down, they're committing a criminal offence.
Okay, we're going to have a listen to Marina Morris's Vox Pop now, all about what the people on the streets of Bristol, what you think about Freemasons.
What do you know about the Freemasons?
What do I know about them? Well, I know they're free, they're sort of secret society, but I've known people who've been in it. I'm not one myself. And they do help friends, relatives out within their group, like families. Like if I know someone who died, and all the members come around and looks after the wife and like the family. I don't necessarily agree with it. I wouldn't join them myself, but in some ways it's a good thing, and they they also contribute towards like charities and things like that. So there's some good things, but some things, secretness is not too good, because in some places of work, offices, it seems that if there's Freemasons, then they're likely to get more promotion because they know, you know, jobs of boys and things like that.
Just pretty much that it's a secret society. They tend to have quite a lot of influence in the community, tend to be well-respected professionals, doctors, lawyers, you know, people in company positions, who then use their network for benefiting their organization, furthering their businesses as a result of the community. They've been around for such a long time. I suppose as long as they're not doing anything in a sort of an illegal and a nasty way, then I can only approve of it. It's like any other organization where people use the organization for their strengths, political power, that sort of thing. Potentially, yes, I suppose so. I mean, if it depends who their members are. Politics is very much like that. Whoever, you know, it's a case of who you know that you can influence. And it's like big business as well. It, you know, as long as you've got the money or the power to influence people, yes, I'm sure.
Yes, I've heard them. I'm very suspicious of them because they're secretive, because they're a secretive society I know nothing about. It doesn't intrigue me. I think possibly it's a club that looks after themselves. Disapprove, yeah. I just don't know enough about them, I suppose. Yes, but possibly, political, could exert political power.
Oh, the Freemasons? Not a lot, except some strange handshakes and rolling up trouser legs. That's about it, really. Well, because I don't know what they really do. I mean, I don't know whether they do anything for the community, or whether they help out, or they just self-supporting, self-help, out for themselves, or what. I mean, that's the feeling I get. They're kind of probably out for themselves, but I haven't a clue. They didn't have much in the way of power. It was more to do with kind of getting together, you know, having good meals, having good drinks in a rather posh room and things like that. I'd imagine they can, they probably would be quite influential in their circles, but what circles that is, I'm not too sure.
I don't really know what they do. So I guess it's kind of, I understand it's for seeing kind of business contacts and that type of thing. So I don't see it's a problem, really.
They have aprons.
And they have a Masonic handshake.
It's just an organisation with some interesting habits, I guess. They have Masonic lodges and things like that, but an interesting initiation rites, I believe. But I've only seen it on the television. No direct knowledge. As long as they don't act against the public interest, they're fine, I guess.
I don't know, because it's such a big secret. I don't know anything about it. No, not really. I don't know. What do I know? I know they have strange rituals and ceremonies. What else do I know? Seem to be probably have each other out.
Do you think the Freemasons are active in Bristol?
I'm sure, yeah. I think as a community, by the nature of their organisation, they're very committed to the community, and I think they're very active across the world. It doesn't, you know, not only Bristol, I would say across the world, they're very active. Famous Masons. I can't say, no. I mean, they've often been rumours of, for instance, in the States, I'm not sure if they're Masons, but I know sort of secret societies that presidents have been involved in as a result of the universities that they were at. I don't know, Harvard, those sort of Ivy League colleges, I don't know.
Yes, I think they've got a place on Park Street, I think.
I presume they'd be everywhere. I think there's like big societies and things like that, perhaps big companies, and I don't really know that much about them.
There's a lot of them in Bristol, yeah. There's quite a lot, yeah. Mm-hmm. They are, yes. I know people involved in them, societies, yeah. Brother-in-law of mine. I don't really know too much about it, I'm afraid, though. There's Masonic Lodge in Bristol, the foot of Park Street, so I guess they are.
Well, that's what the people of Bristol, what you had to say about Freemasons. In the next few minutes, let's just round off what our expert and Freemason investigator, Jerry Coulter, has to say. Jerry, what circles do and what kind of professions do the Freemasons move in, and what kind of professions do people join the Masons?
Well, Freemasons are actually drawn from ranks right across the community, but the people that I'm concerned about in particular are people like certain businessmen and like property developers, people to do with licensing require of various types and everything. This is where the position can be abused, especially where you've got elected members that would grant these licenses or approve these quasi-judicial applications like planning and everything, where they're in this particular club, where they've got the possibility to abuse this position.
Do you think there's any fundamental sort of clash between holding public office and being a Freemason?
I think there is, and I think it should be legislated that you cannot hold public office if you're going to be a member of this organisation. Businessmen, property developers are predators. I don't mind if they lay in coffins and roll their trouser legs up and do all this sort of thing and have these weird meetings. I don't care if they have dinner at the festive board after the lodge meeting and they plot to make a profit or do something. I don't really care about that. But where they're abusing this to the detriment of others, like an objector in a planning application or a licensing application, for a public entertainment license or a liquor license or something like that, where they can abuse this power in this way, it's, I mean, don't forget, local government, it really controls your life day to day more than central government. Planning applications, public entertainment licenses, if you're being blasted out by a disco or something like that, and these people can exert influence through their lodge on elected members, or there are magistrates hearing cases where the magistrate may be brethren and hearing evidence from a policeman who's brethren or from a some other source where he might have to determine, for example, the fate of a licence being revoked. The public need the confidence that it cannot be exploited. In other words, if they're not there, if Masons don't hold these critical pinnacle positions, like magistrates, judges, council officers, councillors, planning inspectors, all this kind of thing, then it's not open to abuse because they're not there. So in other words, if you want to hold a job like that or a public position, then don't be a member of this organisation, because that is a public interest thing. The public have to have the right to know that the people there are not somehow connected with people that could have an adverse effect on an objector.
Can you just round up and tell us some of your websites, if people can have a look on the internet, have a look at some of your experiences?
Yeah, if you want to see about what you get when you go lobbying these people on police authorities and council offices and things like that, you can see it at www.dorsetvictimsupport.org and go to Mason's Corner. Also, we have a YouTube channel, a Dorset Victim Support YouTube channel, which is dealing with police misconduct and the way people get away with that.
And the key document, just to remind people, is the Provincial Yearbook, is that right? And that gives you the lists from each Masonic province of all the Freemasons in that area.
They're based on county lines, but a provincial a yearbook for the province of Dorset or the province of Hampshire or the province of Hertfordshire. In there will be an index at the back of every single invested Mason, which is usually most of them are craft level Masons. Then you get the higher degrees, Mark and Ram, right up to 33rd degree Masons, which are in the other parts of the book.
Anyway, Jerry, thanks ever so much for coming in and talking about all this stuff today and helping us review the news earlier on. And I'm sure we'll be speaking to you again sometime in the future. Now we go back to the 1982 Falklands War, and a Bristol soldier who fought there as a private in the parachute regiment. He approached this programme to confess to having been contravened the Geneva Conventions. One event in the heat of battle for Mount Longdon has been a burden on his mind down the years.
My name is Bryn Richard Cowley, and during the Falklands conflict, I was a private soldier with 6 platoon, 1 section, B company, 3 para. I first heard of the police investigating rumours of POW murders in around about 1993. Various other books that were out, including Excursions to Hell, for example, and other such books, it introduced me to the idea that there'd been some unorthodox treatment of prisoners, and that began me thinking about the entire question.
So, but you had some similar experiences yourself, didn't you? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it took me a while to actually realise, because of the mindset and the control of training that the Paras tend to instil in people. But by 2001, I'd begun to record this on paper, and I essentially wrote to the Argentine embassy directly, giving them full information as possible.
Take us back to 1982 and the heat of the Falklands conflict. What happened there? What did you witness that disturbed you?
Well, in particular, an incident that occurred with the OC of 6th Platoon and myself. We'd just basically come back from an attack to our front. We'd skirmished back. And during that time, a number of people had been injured and killed. The OC of our 6th Platoon had then contacted B Company commanding officer. And it was decided to go firm, basically, in that position, having withdrew from the front, due to the fact that our entire section had been either wounded or killed. We were now basically inoperable, and so we went firm at that particular point. Within about 5 minutes of going firm there, bearing in mind it was pretty black, and there was prisoners to our front.
Can you just explain, this is a bit of jargon for going firm, what this actually means to the layman?
Yeah, it's just a bit of jargon. It means to establish a fixed position rather than going forward in an attack. And so having gone firm, a prisoner was captured by Private Lewis. He was brought in, an Argentine prisoner. We decided to use the prisoner as a form of bait. And so it was my idea to do that. I spoke directly then to the OC of 6th Platoon, and he gave the order that that would be a good idea. The prisoner was then, at gunpoint, forced to move forward into a known killing zone, where he was heard mumbling in Spanish. His hands were raised above his head, and fortunately he wasn't shot. He then collapsed, having tripped over some bodies amongst our wounded.
But this isn't the way that prisoners of war should be treated, is it?
No, certainly not. Prisoners of war deserve to be treated with humane conduct, and that's the reason I'm admitting my part in this, to examine the integrity of all ranks and soldiers in the heat of battle such as this. It happens throughout history. It's probably happening now in the Afghanistan war. The idea was to draw the sniper's fire, hoping that the sniper would think he was one of us. And if then the sniper had opened up, hopefully we may have seen the flash of his weapon and then zeroed in on his position.
So what is your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of doing this with a prisoner?
Well, of course, now in hindsight, so many years on, as I said, since about 1993... I've been giving this considerable thought, but it's been a bit of a wrench from my training and loyalty to the regiment to stick my neck out, as it were, and admit this information.
But isn't it a bit strange for you to be criticising your commanding officer when the suggestion, which is so controversial, to send a prisoner forward as bait, as you said, was actually your suggestion?
Yeah, I'm incriminating myself, I realise, in the process of this, but I think that it's necessary. I've had a long time to think about this now, in conjunction with prisoners being mistreated in Iraq recently, and in general, civilians being killed, perhaps even in Palestine, or the Middle East in general, maybe even the Vietnam War, and in general, people are mistreated. And I'm hoping by introducing this information to also add evidence to the credibility of other books that have been mentioning this type of mistreatment to prisoners.
So what you're saying is, rather than going along with your suggestion, your commanding officer should have halted all idea of using a prisoner of bait at that moment?
Oh, certainly, as an officer, he should have been considerably thinking of the Geneva Convention more than perhaps me as a private soldier. But it just goes to show you that in the heat of the battle, with our troops particularly wounded, and we could hear them obviously asking for help. It just seemed the obvious thing at the time to do strategically.
So was this tactic successful? I mean, what happened to the Argentine prisoner? Was he shot at by the snipers?
Well, fortunately, he wasn't. He was mumbling in Spanish, and I don't know if that made any difference. His hands, nevertheless, were up. And I remember thinking this, you know, why the hell's he got his hands up? As if anyone looked at him from a distance, from a night scope, they'd obviously see that. And so he wouldn't be shot at. But in any case, he wasn't shot at. He fell amongst the prisoners. And the next morning, at first light, the order was given to therefore go forward and retrieve the injured and the dead. And during that process, whilst I retrieved a live soldier called Private Clark, I actually came across this Argentine prisoner who was still alive.
Surely when you join the army, your job is just simply to do what you're ordered and do what you're told by your commanding officer.
That's what the paras are basically all about. We have a reputation for doing what we're told immediately, very disciplined troops. We don't question it at all. So in this way, this is very unusual that I'm now exposing this.
At what point do you think a soldier could or should actually disobey an order? Do you think that there's a line that the soldiers need to draw themselves, or should they just follow orders without question?
Essentially, they should follow orders without question. But in conditions of a battle, in such as this example on London, it's very difficult to make sense of the legal and the illegal within an order. And so it seems to me that at the time, the best strategy, I mean, we're not carrying a Geneva Convention law book in our pockets or any other form of, to the forefront of our minds. So we're just interested in our mates getting them rescued. And so a lot of strategy is bound to be illegal. And it was in the Falklands. If you read these books, you'll see that it was quite clearly illegal.
So what do you think can happen? How could this situation be improved? An absolute guarantee that the Geneva Convention will be adhered to. Is that possible? What would you like to see if you think it is?
That's the major reason that I'm exposing this information. I hope that it will add to the testimonials of other people to give more credence, credibility to what they have said, because the police apparently don't seem to believe it. And by doing this, I hope other people come forward as well and commit their information, because a lot has to be done at training level throughout both the officers and the ranks to introduce to their conscience much more adherence to the laws of war, like the Geneva Convention. They don't seem to remember that in the heat of the battle. They should do, and so should we as troops.
That was Bryn Richard Cowley there, a veteran of the 1982 Falklands conflict and someone who wants to see the military police taking more action when they get reports of British soldiers contravening the Geneva Conventions, which govern warfare. Martin, the Falklands was a long time ago and this was all happening in the heat of battle. Do you think Bryn is right to be still concerned about such what was possibly a trivial incident?
Well, it's obviously not a trivial incident. It's certainly not a trivial incident to him. I think he should be concerned. I mean, there are obviously, every time you step over the line into illegal behaviour, the potential to go further down the line into further illegal behaviour is there. And you know, soldiers should understand what the laws of war are. For example, British soldiers, if they are ordered to carry out torture, should refuse to do it. I mean, it's as simple as that. And we know that that's been going on, that they have been ordered to torture people.
But, I mean, it's very difficult to police this kind of thing, isn't it? Military police it, or what do you want to say, when in the heat of battle. Almost impossible.
Well, I mean, I think what the actual incident that he is describing was a heat of battle incident. And therefore, you could say there's some justification for what happened. But don't forget, if it would have been a British soldier who had been sent out to be a target by the Argentinians, we'd have gone mad. And that's what Richard's point was. If it had been the other way around, we wouldn't have been happy at all, would we?
Right, thanks very much. That's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Dry Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Freemason investigator Jerry Coulter, and our resident Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers, and of course too to Marina Morris for this week's Vox Pop and reports. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including my special report on mobile masts and wireless safety, and find out what's coming up next week by going to bcfm.org.uk and clicking on presenters or podcasts to find my page. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
You are listening to BCFM 93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.